Session number 18779, Reel 3.
Bill Picard, Reel 3.
Yes, he came in the morning, and after a preliminary of just saying, you know, how had I slept past the night, so on, started to go on asking very peculiar sort of questions about, did we all know each other? Were we members of the party, by which I understood him to mean naturally the Communist Party? And then he sort of started on clothes, that we seemed to be dressed differently. Some had good shoes, some didn't, and so on. And I, because of what Joe had said, I kept on saying, well, why do you want to know these sort of things? You know, we're all comrades, we're all going to fight fascism, and so on. But he never seemed to want to give an answer. Anyway, he finally drifted off again. And Joe said to me, he said, I shouldn't say anything more to that chap or to anybody else who comes and asks you. He said, I've spoken to our responsible, and he says, he may just be a passenger who is interested. But on the other hand, I don't think it's wise to say anything. I said, you know, why? So Joe said, well, he said, you know, it's a strange times. And he said, we've got a lot of enemies, and you better not say anything. He might even be a fascist spy of some kind. Well, that was all. I didn't see him again, and nothing seemed to follow from that in the future. Anyway, we arrive eventually down in Perpignan, and we're taken, met again on the state, on the platform, and taken in a coach or what we always referred to as a charabanc in those days, and driven to what seemed to be a disused factory on the outskirts of the town, and are taken in, and there's a field kitchen have been arranged. There's a military type of kitchens have been working on one side of the farm, and there were some French people, and they produced a meal for us, and then we were asked if we would like to just go out and have a look around. And so small parties of us went out, and we were taken to estaminets where we could buy a drink. Oh yes, the other thing was, some characters came round offering to change any English money into francs if we wanted to do that, and so some got some money changed. Then that night, we didn't know whether we were going to move on or not. It got late, and then we were told no, we would be staying there, and we were taken to where we found sacks, looked like flour sacks, filled with straw, and we were given a blanket, and this was what we would use to sleep on that night. And when the place where we were taken was a large room that obviously it had machinery in at one time, because that you could see where it had been taken up, leaving concrete ridges on the floor and odd rusty bolts still sticking up where they'd taken away the machinery and left it. And so we sort of hunted around as it was getting dark. There was only one lamp that had a dim electric light bulb burning high up near the ceiling, and it didn't give much light, so we had to sort of hunt around to find a place to sleep. Now, I'd already become quite friendly with a lad who, on my second arrival in London at the Communist headquarters where we were being voted on, sat next to me, and we'd exchanged names and so on, and called Harry Smith. Well, that's the name he gave. And so we were sticking together. And we found ourselves a niche and had an uncomfortable night. Next day, woke up, and we were told that we would be taken over the Pyrenees, and we thought at first that we were going to go by vehicle over them. And went through that day, not quite knowing when we would move or what was to happen. Some more Brits joined us, and they'd come down earlier, apparently, maybe in several days before, and had been in some other place. I think one of them said, oh, it was a chateau, and they'd been billeted there, and now they came to join us. So obviously something was going to happen. But we always had this feeling that it was very difficult to find to know what was going to happen. Nobody told you anything at all. And I got more information by chatting to the cooks, because I knew enough French to be able to ask questions and get some sort of answers. Some were quite open, others seemed to be reticent or reluctant to say anything. Anyway, that night, I think it was that night, I don't think we spent 2 days there, coach came in, the old charabang type of thing, and we were told to leave our blankets, leave these what do we used to call them, they're sort of palliasse things. We use them quite often afterwards. Anyway, we were packed into the coach, and we started on a journey through the night, climbing all the time. I realized after a while you could hear the engine climbing. We stopped at one place that looked as though we might have been held up, because in the dim light outside I could see there were gendarmes standing there, and somebody came up into the coach and shone a light down the coach, and spoke to the driver. We'd all been told before not to speak in English when we stopped anywhere, to keep quiet. And I had said to either the driver or the person who was speaking to us, I said, "Can we speak in Spanish?" And he says, "Oh, yes, certainly. Spanish is all right," and laughed. And I thought, if they don't mind us being Spanish going that way, but they were more concerned if it were English or another nationality. But it didn't arise. We carried on and finally came to a grinding halt after we'd obviously been climbing for quite a while. And the door opened once again. And this time a military bloke shone a torch down around, spoke to the driver. And I heard the driver telling him that there were Spanish workers returning to Spain, and nothing more was said. He got out. And we drove a short distance out of beyond the post and so on, and then came to a grinding halt. And we all got out, and we were told, or they were told in Spanish, and I was then pushed forward to interpret what was being said. And part of the instructions were that they suggested that as we were going to walk over the top, it would be a good idea if anybody who felt their shoes weren't very substantial or anything, should take a pair of alpargatas, of these rope-soled shoes that were being handed out. Most of our blokes turned them round. They said, "What's an alpargata?" And I could only think of, it's a bit like a tennis shoe. And they thought, no way did they want to go climbing the mountain in a tennis shoe. They would go in their shoes or their boots. Well, some of them were fairly thin. I actually because I was interested in climbing, and had done quite a bit of climbing, and thinking, "Oh, I want a tough pair of boots." Actually, had a pair of lightweight sort of climbing boots, so fairly substantial things on my feet. But quite a lot of the others hadn't. Just as I also had brought a rucksack around, because I had I'd been in the scouts and I camped and done things like that, and I thought, well, we didn't know, quite honestly, whether we were going to be given uniforms or what, or at that stage. And so I thought it seemed a sensible thing to have. I only wished afterwards that I had brought along some cutlery and things. Never thought about that at all, but it would have been quite handy. Anyway, we then were lined up, and Spaniards turned up then, and Comrade White, who was with Joe, and I thought was one sort of in charge or something. He seemed to be. We'd elected him actually to be our responsible, to be representative for us. Mainly because he was an elderly man. The two of the young commie youths that had been in the youth movement had been very anxious to to be given the job of being, but the majority had voted for old Bill White, because he was a party member, but he was a nice and elderly man, and he'd been a soldier in the First World War anyway. And so he was, we looked upon as our sort of leader. Not Joe. Joe sort of all stood to the background and didn't push himself forward at the time. Though obviously I realise, used me to be interpreter and things like that. And so when the Spaniards came down, they obviously wanted to know who was going to interpret or be in charge and so on. And I was simply joined with my friend Harry, and we just fell in, and I was called out, and Joe says, "What did he say?" And the man repeated to me, and then started talking to me about the different things that we were to do. And he explained that we were going to climb the mountain, we were going over the Pyrenees, and we had to get over before dawn to cross the frontier, because the French had a frontier people on. And though they had sort of squared the thing with the gendarmerie, the military weren't going to be so amenable. But they thought it was all, everything would be all right, but we would have to keep moving and climb. And the Spaniard was making comments about some of my comrades who were in just jackets and things like that, and said, you know, they shouldn't have been sent like that. They should have been told they need warm clothing and all this. And I said, well, we weren't told anything. I said, we thought we were probably going over in the charavan, you see, in the camion. So we set out, and they were told they would follow. Each one must follow the one in front. And at one stage, they unreeled a roll of cord, and told a group that were always lagging that they to hold on to the cord and not let it go, because they must follow the man in front. And there was no moon, so it became very dark, and we were moving up amongst trees, so it got really quite dense at the time, and you really were, and we were stumbling. Nobody was to smoke, you mustn't, nor strike matches and so on, and to try and move as quietly as we could. And so we spent that night with short breaks, literally walking up the lower slopes of the Pyrenees. And in the dawn, just before early dawn, we actually, it began to flatten out, and we began to reach the top. And eventually we crossed over the frontier, and finally they had to go back and help one or two blokes who'd just collapsed at the side of the road, so exhausted. I mean, when you think of it, some of these lads had never been on anything like this. I mean, to me, quite honestly, I thought of it rather like climbing the pig path on Snowdon. Just you go up a path which tourists can do, basically, you know, in daylight, it's on steep and so on, but not worse than that. It just lasted longer and went on longer. But to some of my comrades on there, they'd never been out of London or places like that, and had no idea. And of course, shoes had fallen to pieces, and they wished they had these alpargatas, which the Spaniards had offered them at first, but they'd spurned, which are quite, you know, quite good, and give you a good grip as well. After all, it's what the Spanish peasant used, and so on. And we finally, whatever, they went back, picked up a few of those who were just stragglers, and we waited once we were across the frontier. And then when we'd all had a rest, we sat down the other side as the dawn came up. And Spain was sort of in shadow, but France gradually lit up, and we had a view of the snow caps stretching away to the north of us. And we carried on over. It was a lovely dawn, and we carried over, started to go downhill. And then a very short distance, we came to some huts on the side of the road, and some people men came out with rifles, and they all seemed not at all welcoming. We sort of thought, well, they're going to throw their arms wide and welcome us all. And I sensed that Spanish guides, they'd gone ahead of the column and was talking, and I sort of strolled around down, passing the others who'd all flopped out on the side of the track, feeling that they probably would want to know what was being said. And I realized that our blokes were being quite apologetic, and they were Spaniards, but these were Catalans that had stopped us there with their rifles. And after a lot of talk, gradually the atmosphere changed, and the cigarettes were offered around, and they became more friendly. But when the Spaniards came back to them, they said to us that we've got to get moving and move quickly. Now, our column was not just the English. There was also a whole section of French as well, or European French as well. So it wasn't only just our lot that had come up the mountain. But they'd gone ahead and had all moved on down the French element. Partly they were, I think, fitter than us. Probably a lot tougher men too, you know, and there were quite a number of middle European and older. A lot of ours were fairly young, with the odd old First World War soldier amongst them. But these others were much tougher. And of course, as we subsequently realised, practically all the Europeans had military training. The Brits hadn't, except for ex-soldiers from the First World War. And so we were really novices, and this showed up very much. I mean, when we started to do drills and things like that, the Europeans and the older men, you know, had all drilled before, and so they could do it. We were always the shambles, the Brits, and that because so many of us, as I said, hadn't been in the forces.
Why do you think that you didn't get more of a warm welcome?
I'll get on to that. Because these were anarchists, Catalan anarchists. And they were, as I subsequently discovered, they were very suspicious they knew that it was the Communist Party bringing the people in. And they were convinced that we were all communists and that we were going to be used at some time, literally, to fight the anarchists. And also, of course, the other group that was some of the Spanish extreme socialists, or a split of from the Spanish Communist Party, were labelled as Trotskyists, because they'd taken very much that attitude and didn't want to be dictated to by Moscow. That's another interesting thing I discovered quite early on. I used to hear a reference to la casa, meaning the house, and that this was a term that the Spanish communists used when they were referring to instructions or orders coming from Russia, from Stalin and the Russian Communist Party. And of course, Stalin was at that time sending over people, and they were gradually, when they formed the International Brigade, all the top-notch people, though they might put up a Spaniard as a sort of front, the man behind him was always a Russian or an international communist under the Comintern, under Russia. I mean, the comandante of our lot at first was Gal, Comrade Gal, who I think was a Hungarian or something like that, but he was a Moscow-trained man. Bastard. Ruthless they were. And the Spaniard quite often were sort of half apologizing for things that, I mean, they can be pretty tough with them, but they weren't quite as ruthless as some of these Russians who just looked upon us, we were expendable in their eyes at all. Anyway, at the stage we went down, came to a small village later after we left the anarchist element. They were all friendly enough after once they sort of seen us, and I suppose they must have reckoned, well, there's a pretty poor lot this lot there, all sitting around with blistered feet, feeling very sorry for ourselves, or my comrades were. And we went down to a small village late in the morning, and then trucks came up, and we were all packed into these trucks, and we were taken down to big castle on the side of the hill.
Figueras.
Yeah, there's two ways of saying it too. It's Figueras, the Spanish, when Figueres, the Catalans always used to refer it. Yeah, Figueras. It's it was an ancient castle actually they were using, and we got out of the trucks. Oh, the great big gates opened, that's right, and we were driven into this courtyard, Figueras, and then we were all had to be taken into an oficina where there was a Spanish officer, and we went through all the rigmaroles of taking our names, and then there was a lot of joking because they could never pronounce some of the English names of the different chaps. Some they could get all right and not others. And we were then signed on in the Spanish army and told that we were given a sort of what do we used to call it? Not a cachet, sort of, I think, rather like the army the army paybook thing with our name, number and so on it. And later we were actually photographed and had to have our photos stuck on this thing and then stamped over the top. But at this stage, that was always done. We weren't given uniforms or anything then. Then we went into a sort of subterranean place, rather like an old. It was a medieval castle anyway, you see, and so it was one of the sort of dungeon areas, I would have thought, underground or half underground. And there were women there cooking meals. And it's when I first began to realize the difference in the Spanish, the words you could use or not use. And I got ticked off. I addressed a woman who was dishing out food in what you would say was the polite way of addressing a woman, you know, and so on. And she ticked me off because I was to use tu, and which was the intimate way of putting something, and it wasn't the call of madame, which was sort of thing. She was a camarade, she was now a comrade, and all this sort of thing. And
you used usted. Hmm? You used usted.
Yes, usted. Yeah, and there were a lot of words that you weren't allowed to use any longer, and the way you addressed everybody and so on. So. I began to pick that up there. We were given a meal, and then we were sort of dismissed to sort of spend the rest of the afternoon. And it was a strange way. They whitewashed it all the way round, and they had plant pots on a sort of what would have been the work behind the parapets, you know, around the top. And there was groups of men drilling down in this fairly large square in the middle of the, which was the courtyard, I suppose, of the old castle parts. And but we were left alone to our own devices that time at first, and then we saw groups of the French that had come over with us, or the Europeans. I keep saying French because most of them spoke French, but I think a lot of them were refugees from the other parts of Europe, communists who'd had to escape, just as we had Germans amongst them who came out and joined the Telman Brigade, which was all composed entirely of Germans who hated Hitler and fascism. They had personal experience of it. Anyway, we went down. We made up a party and we went down into town on our own. And I was raked in to go and sort of act as interpreter for them, and we went to one or two estaminets and found our way down by the station at the bottom down there, and eventually ended up in a brothel because, of course, some of the comrades definitely wanted to go in there. And on the whole, I think, you know, it was more for companionship, because surprising what a lot just sat and drank and talked to the women, you know, didn't go upstairs with them at all. And I learned quite a bit chatting to them. They were Catalans, and so made a great point of saying they weren't Spanish, you know. No soy español. Oh, he's a Catalan. And but if they either understood Spanish or used Spanish, you know, rather than the Catalan. I mean, it's very similar, but there's quite a lot of differences in it. And I began to realize that their feelings towards the church, you see, it was quite ambivalent. They hated the position and the priests and the support that the church gave to the landed gentry, or were the tools of the landed gentry, or the big landowners anyway. And so they had a strong feeling there, but at the same time, they didn't like the desecration of the churches by the extreme elements on our side. The syndicalists had burnt churches, certainly the anarchists had, and at first I think the communists did. But later I think they began to realize probably that it was slightly anti-productive. It was turning a lot of the local against us when it was not necessary. I mean, you know, they weren't in power yet, so they didn't see the point of it. They realized it was anti-productive to upset the locals. And I can remember this girl in this brothel telling me they was very concerned that the black virgin at a monastery just north or north of Figueres had been damaged or desecrated, and she, though she said she was a comrade and all this sort of thing, and took, I assumed, a socialist or non-church attitude, she still was sufficiently superstitious to be concerned that they were going to have a lot of bad luck because of this. And I met this continuously, that the country people didn't, on the whole, want to damage the churches and so on, though quite often they could be quite ruthless in killing the priest there. Not all. I mean, some of them wouldn't. They'd obviously had a good relationship, but in other places they could be ruthless with them. A lot of this sort of thing, of course, was really quite a shaker to our lads coming from here, because in comparison to what the Spaniard had often had, and to a certain extent the revolutionary feeling in France that can get quite hot when you're having political disagreements. At that time, I mean, the English on the whole, we were, except for the Moseley business, we were very law-abiding. I mean, like the Jarrow marchers could walk the whole length of England, and there wasn't any fights, any trouble at all. And everybody was full of sympathy and used to come out and give them cups of tea and all the rest. Same sort of thing that went on later in the war years. But there was never quite that sort of tolerance there. So it took us a while to sort of begin to understand a lot of this thing. We then were taken by train through the night. I think it was, we only spent one night in Figueres, and then we went to Barcelona. And we were given a great welcome there. They made quite a lot, met parades, met us at the station and all the rest of it, and speeches were given, and we were marched up through the town, and we all thought, no doubt, that we're great heroes, and we hadn't yet done anything at all. And then we were put up in the barracks that I think at the time we were told was called the artillery barracks, down near the harbour. We'd come in from the Station Française, the French station, that's to the east of Barcelona. And the barracks were quite near there. Then we'd gone up the Ramblas, and we had an evening in which we were left to ourselves to wander around. And I got chatting to various Spaniards and began to get a picture of it. And I realized that there was quite a lot of division about some of the people. We would go into a bodega, into a drinking place, and I'd be talking, and I'd find out that everybody there seemed to be, we'll say, communist. Others claimed they were just socialiste, and then others were the Trotskyite elements. So there was these divisions, and to my companions, it meant nothing. They were all Spaniards, and that was fine. But I began to pick up these sort of nuances, the differences between, and I realized that quite a lot of them, you know, didn't trust each other at all. And they'd had the uprising, and they'd sort of come together to get rid of the fascist element that had taken control, like the police and so on. And quite a lot of them had sided, I suppose, with Franco at once, because they were against the socialist elected government. So there was already then, and that was in the January of 37. There were divisions that were, of course, later in the year were to burst out in the upheavals that came about